Members, I'm going to call the Jobs and Economic Development Committee to order. We have a quorum, so I know Representative Zong has been looking at the minutes. Would you care to move them?
So moved.
Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes for April 11th? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 We have a set of opposed, same sign. And we have the minutes approved. We don't have any other minutes, do we? Nope. Okay. I am, you know, I wrote it all down, and then I, no, here it is. There is a motion to make, which is, so, you know, it's House File, which number is it? House File 2311, and that is in the possession of the committee at the present time. So, Representative Sundin, would you move to take up 2311 again?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to take up 2311 at this point.
Thank you. All those in no, we don't need no vote. Would you care to give us a? I don't think you need to give us a too much of the because we've already heard it in committee, but we need to amend it. Correct.
We've not heard this in committee. No.
It was heard.
It was on the omnibus.
Briefly,
I will have the commissioner describe 2311, then I will make a motion to amend it.
Madam Commissioner.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain House File 2311. So Minnesota Statutes 176.1812 allows an employer and a labor union to enter into a collective bargaining agreement for certain obligations and procedures related to workers' compensation. The Union Construction Workers' Compensation Program, the UCWCP, administers a program for a group of employers and unions who have entered into these collective bargaining agreements. So there are features of the UCWCP that include an agreed upon alternative dispute resolution system, list of exclusive health care providers to treat the work injury, limited lists of impartial physicians to conduct independent medical exams, and a limited list of vocational rehabilitation providers. So what this bill is just very technical amendment to streamline the process by which people can enter into these arrangements and exit them. And so I'm going to have my staff quickly go through what are the provisions of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Laura Zajac from the Department of Labor and Industry. Very briefly, this bill is about the provision of information from the program to the department. The department has oversight over the Union Workers' Compensation Construction Program. Currently, we're required to approve an employer's entry into the program, and this dates back to when the program was limited to construction. Now that any employer can join with their union, it's not needed for the department to approve an employer's entry into the program, but we would like to be notified when an employer joins and when an employer leaves so that we can track those claims and monitor their progress. The other changes in the bill relate to how we know which claims are in the program. Currently, we don't know which individual workers' compensation claims are in the program, and we're asking that insurers and payers report that to us when they would otherwise have to tell us about the claim. And insurers and payers are on board with that change because they know which claims are in the program. Because of that change, we'll be able to pull better data about the program and about how it's succeeding and any trends. And in exchange, we've limited the annual data report that the program currently has to provide to us because most of the data will be in our system on a claim-by-claim basis. The only information that they'll need to provide to us is related to their dispute resolution process. And we've worked out with the program the general scheme of what that will look like, and they'll provide us contested claim data on a claim-by-claim basis. So that's a very brief overview. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier, Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. So I don't know a lot about this area of law, but I sit on the Judiciary Committee, so I hear a lot of discussion about how the data is sort of listed under the Data Privacy Act. So could you talk a little bit about how this data, especially the individual data that you will now be receiving, will be classified?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Robbins, so currently workers' compensation data is only available to the employee who's making the claim, the employer, the insurer, the department, and the program, and that will not change under this proposed legislation. We do have these claims in our system already, but we don't know which ones are part of the program and which are not. So the only additional data piece that we'll be collecting is which claims in our system are part of the program and which aren't.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, but having it de-identified as an individual claim, is that, will that be public data? Can people look at that?
No.
Please go ahead.
Chair, thank you. Representative Robbins, no, it will not be public who has claims and which claims are part of the program, except on an aggregate basis when we would publish statistics about how general claims are doing and how claims that are part of the program are doing in terms of resolution, benefits paid. Those would be de-identified if we were to publish any research or statistics.
Thank you. Sorry, I lost my microphone in the black hole down there. So sorry. I don't know where it went. And
take a hand.
just one. We'll
go right ahead.
Thank you. Will this also be referred to the Judiciary Committee?
Now, as I understand it, Representative Lesch has taken a look at this, and he says he doesn't need to see it because there's really no change to the data.
Thank you.
Madam, any other questions? Seeing none, Madam Commissioner, did you look like, okay. Representative Sundin, did you?
To 2311, my understanding is we need to adopt that, and then I have an amendment after. Or?
We'll adopt the amendment first. So okay. If you'd like to move your amendment.
I'll move the amendment to the A19 to be amended to the 2311.
Thank you. You care to explain it yourself, or would you like to have your
Oh, boy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could really use a little hand on this.
Commissioner, would you care to explain it, the amendment?
Yes, I would be happy to, Chair, and members of the committee. Again, I'm Nancy Leppin, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. So first for you to understand that this proposed amendment has been recommended by the and has been discussed and recommended by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. The purpose of these amendments is to allow for the department to complete the implementation of a modernized workers' compensation technology system, which will replace an outdated system that's been in effect since 1992. So the new system is called Campus, and the purpose of the system, so currently the department works with paper and or imaged copies of paper, and that if you want to get access to any information in your workers' compensation file, you either need to write to the department a call and request us to then make copies of the documents that you want, or you need to come into the department, and at designated terminals you need to sit and open your file and look at your file. And this is true whether you are a worker, an insurer, an attorney, et cetera. So obviously this creates significant inefficiencies in this system itself, because this is a very paper-driven system which has many steps in the process, and therefore being able to more effectively not only see the data in the system but actually monitor what the progress is of your claim is really quite critical to the system's effectiveness and efficiency. So beginning in the early teens, the department began to discuss the replacement of what it calls its imaging system. That system is actually reflected in statute and how it works. So the idea was that we wanted sort of immediate online access to workers' compensation claims documents, the ability to file documents electronically, the ability for the department to more effectively exchange and share data among the three agencies that are responsible primarily for the workers' compensation system, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and DLI. We also wanted to create a mechanism why people weren't just looking at individual pieces of paper, but we could create a system that helped particularly injured workers and employers be able to more effectively sort of monitor and where the claim was in the process. So building around these documents, then ability to track and be informed and have messages sent to you regarding where you are and the next steps in the process. So the department, with significant engagement both internally, looking at our business processes, but also significant engagement with stakeholders, began to then build the stories for each of these key processes of the system and began to work to develop then the system itself. So as that process has evolved, the department also recognized that it was going to need to have the law now reflect this new system. So we needed to stop talking about an imaging system and talking about this new IT system. We also recognized that a lot of the things that address things like data practices, things that addressed filing obligations in this over 100-page statute was now scattered all about in it. And therefore, people to really understand how this new system would work, we wanted to consolidate provisions. We wanted to clarify and be more specific as to exactly how the existing law would work in the context of this new system. So the desire was not to change the status of data. It was not to change legal obligations of employers or workers or insurers, other than the obligation to now use this new system that we would ultimately go live with. So as we have been working on developing the system, engaging with stakeholders, we've now needed to gradually and incrementally make changes, recognizes that we needed to make changes to the law. Again, the idea was not to change substantive rights, not to change the classification of data, not to change basic responsibilities under the workers' compensation law, but it was basically to take that law and frame it consistent with how this new system would work. So we are now at the point where we are, we've mapped out all the storylines of all the processes, and we're now doing the coding, bringing in users, having them look at the system, use the system, make adjustments to it. But we're we're now at the point where we can lock down the language that we need to then finalize, make the last 18 months to complete the work that needs to be done, and make sure that the system we are building is consistent with the law. Now reflects that system as we have designed it to date. So Jessica Stimmick, who's the general counsel for the department, can walk you through the sections themselves so that you can understand, what is intended. And I think also to clarify that even though there's a lot of language underlined, mainly that language is underlined in part because, like I said, we're trying to consolidate all these disparate sections of the law so people can actually sort of see how the new system will work, and also to make clear that and to provide some specificity where even the Department of Data Practices, Office of Data Practices, has advised us. So there's certain parts of the law that are old enough that they don't even reference the Data Practices Act. We had them review the law and give us feedback as to how we should adjust it or draft it. We took on their comments and we made those revisions. So this has already been reviewed by them and responds to many of the recommendations that they had made over the years regarding the law, including providing citations to the Data Practices Act that previously weren't in the law. To clarify how the two laws related. So Jessica is going to give you a walkthrough of the provisions so that you can sort of
before,
see it.
Before she starts,
people have questions. Sure.
Representative Baker?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to wait till actually they're finished, and I'll ask my question then. Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, Chairman and members. My name is Jessica Stimmick. I'm General Counsel for the Department of Labor and Industry. Sections 1 through 4 are updated to add definitions to agency, campus, division file, and document. That's on pages 1 and 2 of the amendment. Of note, the definition of division file, it's currently defined in Chapter 1415, but as part of this legislation, we wanted to make clear what is and is not in the division file and to clarify who has access to the entirety of the division file or parts of the division file. That's what necessitated the definition of division file. Under, on pages, starting on page, the bottom of page 2 and up on the top of page 3, under 176.231, from lines 3.5 through 3.13, it adds three conditions under which a first report of injury must be filed with the Department of Labor and Industry. For example, when permanency is paid, when there's a dispute on the file, or when there's vocational rehabilitation on the file, the way that the system is being programmed, a first report of injury is necessary for sequencing subsequent documents. So we wanted to make sure that we were covering all conditions under which we would have subsequent filings. Lines 3.22 through 3.25 require the insurer to report when an injury is covered by the UCWCP. This is similar to the language that Laura just discussed. It's just the cross-reference that she mentioned in 231. It clarifies, starting at 3.26, it clarifies when a first report of injury and subsequent reports must be filed with the commissioner. Starting on line 4.28, it describes the process for adopting and updating new technical requirements for e-filing reports according to the standard developed by the International Association of Industrial Accident Boards and Commissions. And by way of background, we mandated electronic submission of first report of injury data in 2014. And as part of this project, we're mandating electronic transmission of subsequent report of injury data, whereas currently we are accepting paper forms.
So again, it's not the same data needs to be filed.
Right.
Now it's providing for that it will be filed electronically and not be filed by paper. So that's a whole on purpose of the underlying.
Right. And continuing on to page 5, it describes the process for updating and amending the National IIBC Claims Release Standard and the corresponding implementation guide. Starting on page 6.15, this clarifies and makes more specific longstanding existing language governing who has access to the division file generally. And then starting on page 7, it provides more specificity what a valid authorization must include for access to the division file. Starting on line 7.22, access to the division file without an authorization, it describes who has electronic access to the division file or parts of the division file depending upon the entity's role in the workers' compensation system. Each has a statutory role in receiving, providing, paying, or reimbursing benefits or administering a claim on behalf of a statutory entity.
So again, this is just
that's correct. This is clarifying who has current access to the data. There were a couple of places where we added some clarification. For example, from 7.26 to 7.30, the primary parties and defendants have the same access as they've always had. 176 in different parts of 176 indicate that an heir has access to the information, but we wanted to make clear that in one section that the heir has the same access as dependents or the employee. So that's one of the one of the examples of how we're clarifying the language, taking it from a different piece of 176 and making sure it's in one place. Another example is parties that file a motion to intervene. Currently, under current law, under the rules, they have access to pleadings related to the dispute for which they intervene. But this makes clear that they have access to only those documents in the division file. So this is putting in one place what is in the rules in different parts of 176, who has access to the entirety of the division file or parts of the division file. Is that? Starting on line 8.15, this describes an attorney's access to the division file. So currently, this is the same access as provided in 176.2611. It requires the attorney to file certain information with the Department of Labor and Industry to obtain access, for example, a retainer agreement, a notice of appearance. and clarifies when the attorney no longer has authorization to the division file. The reason that we made sure that we had time limits is that the having an electronic system allows the system to be programmed to grant and revoke access after a certain period of time has passed. Currently, an individual is looking at every request for paper documents or access to the file in person in the St. Paul office. So we wanted to make clear when that access starts and when it ends. It doesn't change the access that they have to the information. Starting on line 9.13, this is longstanding practice, but it allows the department to update inaccurate contact data of the parties in Canvas. Starting on line 9.13, subdivision 9B, this governs interagency access to the division file. This is, again, already permitted by 2611. Currently, OAH, Work Comp Court of Appeals, and DLI all have jurisdiction over disputes, depending upon the nature of the dispute. This ensures that agencies have access to information related to disputes pending at one of the other agencies as needed to perform the statutory functions of the agencies. And these are the same limitations. There are some limitations to the data that other agencies can access. For example, data created, used, or maintained for internal operations of the agency, confidential mediation statements. There were certain things that we wanted to make sure that stayed outside of the interagency access to information. But this is existing.
Current practice.
Current law, 2611. So starting on 10.11, subdivision 9C, this addresses what DLI investigative data is placed in the division file and what the classification of the data is. This just makes specific what has been the practice and wanted to make clear what is and is not in the division file and who has access to what. Given there is going to now be kind of an electronic silo of information and transfer of information into the division file versus, again, a person making the determination of what is in the division file and when. Starting on 12.6, 176.253, this provides that a licensed TPA with a or third party administrator, with a campus account may act on behalf of an employer and insurer as provided in their contract with the employer insurer, unless the department is notified otherwise. So the TPA currently has the same access as whomever they have the contract with, but it's necessary to clarify in the statute that they have the same access as the other entities that are specified, so that campus can be programmed accordingly, so that we know that if they've got a contract with the employer that they have the same access as the employer does, for example. Also, campus will serve documents on the third-party administrator of or for an employer and insurer electronically versus by paper. Any service requires clear statutory authority for service on the TPA, so that is why we updated that particular statute. Starting on page 13, line 13.6, the first subdivision 2 clarifies the applicability in terms of eliminating reference to the imaging system and cross-referencing the report that's described later in the section. So that's purely technical. Starting on line 14.6. So the amendments revise terminology to reflect replacement of the imaging system with campus. Describes interagency read-only access to OAH and DLI's case management systems and requires transmission of dispute-related documents and data beginning August 2020 when campus is implemented. So again, this is to clarify what happens with the data currently transferred between the agencies when we move from paper to an electronic system. Starting on line 15.2, data privacy. This reflects that as of 8/31/20, when OAH transmits required information to DLI after campus is implemented, the amendments to 176.231 that we already discussed govern access to the information in the division file, and that post-implementation subdivision 6 will still govern access to documents at OAH. So what we wanted to make clear is that Subdivision 6, which is current law, is what applies to OAH data. But once they transmit it, as required under the statute to DLI in campus, that when it's in the division file, it's subject to the data practices language that we had discussed earlier in 231. Starting on line 1520, it clarifies that posted notices of proceedings not include the employee's name or any part of the employee's name. This is to protect the employee's identity. Initials are okay, but we wanted to make sure that employees' whole names, last names aren't published, so that data remains not public. So starting on 15.26 and continuing on to page 16, these describe the requirements of campus. For example, single secure electronic service and filing with the Department of Labor and Industry and Work Comp Court of Appeals, electronic transmission of documents between the agencies, and electronic access to the division file by those authorized. So this just puts into statute what we think that our stakeholders should expect from the electronic system. Starting on line 16.19, this requires the commissioner to develop a plan and statutory proposal for improvements to campus by January 2021. The plan must ensure single filing and single calendaring system to include OAH. So starting on 16.27 and continuing on to page 17, this describes who has to create and maintain an account in campus for purposes of e-filing and access to the division file. Of note, it permits but does not require an employee to create an account. So starting on the top of page 18, this gives the commissioner discretion to assess a penalty for failure to create or maintain an account. We did add good cause language as a result of consultation with the bar. Really, this we wanted to make sure that we have authority to enforce people using the system, because if they can still file in paper, then it renders the electronic
system. I'm going to ask
system.
You to
sure
be done soon, because we have another amendment and another testifier.
Okay. So 275 just clarifies the agency's authority to accept or reject a filing, requires filers to use the WID instead of a social security number if the WID is available, and that if a document's inadvertently filed at the wrong agency by an injured worker, that it's deemed appropriately filed. 19 applies the definition of an affidavit to the district court rules. It amends proof of service requirements for agencies and parties. 281 just requires electronic transmission of work product, basically, between the agencies. On page 20, 285 provides that an employee can't be required to electronically file or accept electronic service of a document. It requires documents to be electronically filed or served on the Commissioner or Work Comp Court of Appeals. It clarifies that electronic can't include fax or email, and extends the e-filing deadline to 11:59 p.m. It also notes that if the filing is received after 4:30 p.m., that it extends the time for a party to respond by a day. It allows the commissioner, the work comp, court of appeals, and parties to electronically serve documents on another party through campus. It allows rehab providers to attest that signatures have been obtained electronically. Start on page 22. I already discussed a couple of these. The employee can't be required to accept e-service, the extension of the time to assert a right. It also clarifies obligations regarding proofs of service. And then the final amendment to 176.312, this is the only one that isn't really required to implement campus, but it was requested by the bar and the Office of Administrative Hearings, that it extends the time for a party to assert a petition for reassignment from 10 to 20 days.
Of a
compensation judge. Sorry.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think this is a good amendment, because it's taking this paper world into a obviously where it needs to be. As an employer, I can't tell you this is exciting to just know it's going to get tightened up, and I hope that it's going to be a lot of efficiencies in St. Paul and where the office is actually handling all this stuff. But I have to tell you, this detail that you went through, I think, went over most of our heads, and this is not the committee that I think kind of needs to dive in deep on this. Now, and again, I know the chair said, Representative and Chair Lesch doesn't need to see this or has decided not to see this. I just question that. Because it's a good system, and I trust that the council has went through this, and I think that we've got smart people looking at this. But we're now allowing a third party vendor to come in and start doing some things that we haven't done before, and this system. And one of my questions was going to be, who's building it? All that stuff that we are now accustomed to asking around this place about who is building the system, who will have access to it that doesn't now because it doesn't exist. So I just want to let's start with who's building this IT project, and is it a third-party shelf, off-the-shelf kind of a thing? Can you help me with that a little bit, please?
Before we get too far, can I correct myself? I was notified that Representative Lesch will be looking at this afternoon to determine whether he wants to see it. So we're going to be sending it to Ways and Means without we can't recommend where it goes. And if he wants to see it, he'll request it.
And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for clarifying that. This would have been something that I would have really asked detail. I want to see Chair Lesch and our lead, Peggy Scott, Representative Scott, look at this in depth because they know this language much, much better than most of us here. So I just think this is good. It just has to be vetted properly. So thank you for that clarification, and I hope that they do see this. If I could just get the
idea. One other piece to this. This bill came. We're having the hearing because we realized both the House and the Senate realized we put the money for this into our omnibus bill. It's one of our same and sames that we might get to today, we hope, did not put any detail to what they had to do and what they were going to do. So anyhow, to your question.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. The system is being built by CapTech. CapTech has built other workers' compensation technology systems around the country. It's a custom build, and it's based off of the requirements of an RFP that we posted 2017, I think.
Mr. Chair, and what is that? Again, I came to this committee kind of late, too, so I don't know what the number was. What is the build cost estimate on this project?
So when we – sorry, Representative, thank you. When we first did the discovery phases of this project, the vendor estimated – an independent vendor, separate from the implementation vendor, estimated that the project would cost between $17 and $51 million. We asked for $16 million, hoping to be conservative, and we wanted to make sure that the amount didn't affect the assessment. After CapTech came in and did the requirements gathering, we had another ask for $3 million to ensure that we could complete the full scope of the project.
And final question,
Mr.
Chair.
No, I just wanted to say, and that within that amount, the $16 million will handle handle the development of the system itself. But we are also then wanting to have significant money to be able to do training, to have a help desk, to make sure that our internal staff are well prepared for this change. So we're doing all of the change management. We're also making sure that we're working extensively with all of the stakeholders and that we are going to be able to respond to their needs for training, their needs for sort of immediate assistance. So part of the additional amount of money that we've asked for is to ensure that we can affect the system will be effectively accepted and used by the many different stakeholders that will need to engage with it, and that we are prepared to make sure in very real time to respond to any questions, any issues that they have with the system. We've also built into it, obviously, in that iterative process, we may need to make some adjustments, so we've also made sure that the resources are there to handle that. There is no intention to come back to the legislature to ask for any additional money to complete this project. And we are working with a really excellent vendor who's done this type of system in several other states. They've been on budget and they've been on time in each of those other experiences. So we feel confident that we have identified someone and who has also demonstrated over the last couple years that they are capable, that they are capable to bring this in on time.
And Mr. Chair, final question maybe to the commissioner. What I learned through the MNLARS process was that throughout the years that we have been kind of making our statutes more complicated, have you had a chance to go through those things, clean them up so that the merging of the paper world and the technology world is set for this? Because, again, it caused so many great problems, and I hope that that's been done. And also, final, is there a lot of work for the employer to learn about a new system that we'll be accessing as this goes forward?
So, first of all, Chair, Commissioner. Representative Baker, excuse me. We've been fully engaging all of the stakeholders in actually the development of the system. So we have stakeholder groups that we bring in have brought in regularly as we've been building out the storyline for each of the key processes. So they've been heavily engaged in sort of how this is designed from the beginning to meet their needs and how they interact with the system. And we will, as I said, we will have the necessary support and training for those users once the system, in advance of the system going live and once the system goes live. Now, I'm sorry, it went right out of my brain, the first question that you asked.
I think you covered it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of a follow-up on the line of thinking for Representative Backer. I just wanted to be clear when you said the My apologies. When you said the appropriation is in the omnibus bill, can you clarify then the dollar amount that's in the bill? And I just want to kind of link up with what the commissioner said, that we have funded it or we are funding it, and you stated there it won't be an additional appropriation request. Can you clarify that, Mr. Chair?
Off the top of my head, Representative Haley, I cannot give you the exact dollar figure. I'm sure the commissioner has it at her fingertips, but I believe it's around $3 million.
So, Chair, Representative Haley, it is $3 million. It's $3 million from the special compensation fund that would be used to pay for this, bring to completion the project, which includes, of course, completing the development of the system, but also then everything that is critical to ensuring that a system will work, which is user acceptance, ensuring that people have adequate access to training and to real-time assistance by the department as the system goes live, and then any resources that may be needed to make any adjustments that we discover along the way.
Representative Haley.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you, Commissioner. Just one quick follow-up. Can you clarify that? It sounds like this is fully operational within your department, and is it then all your staff that manages it ongoing, or does Minute IT get involved, and is there any crossover there with who's managing it or implementing it long term?
Commissioner?
Chair, Representative Haley, that the system's operation in the long term will be jointly done by both the department and with Minute support. So part of what's been involved in this project is, as CapTech has helped us develop the system, we are also then making sure that we have in place the necessary expertise and the resources, human resources, to be able to maintain the system going forward. And that would be a combination of department subject matter experts and Minute staff.
Seeing no other questions, would you like to renew your motion to adopt the A-19 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to renew my motion to amend 2311 with the A-19.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You have your amendment on it. I think there's one more. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I have the A1 amendment, I believe it is. And the author and I, Representative Sandina, spoke about this, but it's an issue that I wanted to bring up. Been working on trying to figure out the adequacy of some disability benefits specific to at least the police, and that is what the amendment does, is to offer a study to take a look at the adequacy of the current benefits available to disabled or injured police officers. And so I wanted to bring this up here. I understand the route that the current bill has taken, so I would like to just offer a test to fire and then withdraw the amendment, and we'll try to be brief.
Feel free. Would you do you want to explain it, or do you want your testifier to say, fill in any details or doubts that might be?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the amendment is pretty simple. It's just to have the Commission on Pensions and Retirement study the adequacy of the benefits I mentioned, but I'd like to bring my testifier to speak to why it would be necessary and a good idea to talk to.
Okay, and that would be not retirement and pensions, but on workers' comp. Because you said pensions and retirements, and I don't want to cross hairs with a particular chair.
Understood. The way the amendment is drafted, it is in the
work comp.
Well, no, that line 1.4 is the Commission on Pensions and Retirement, but that is why we are will be withdrawing it. But also out of respect for the process that the bill has traveled with the current author.
Okay.
But having the commissioner here, I think it'd be an appropriate opportunity just to highlight the need for a study of police disability benefits.
Well, I am always for workers that are injured to get a decent deal, so I think this is a good amendment, but it's out of my purview, but I would like to hear from your testifier.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wendy Wolf, and I come in front of you today to speak in favor of Amendment A1. The general public and most of the people in government believe that we do a good job of taking care of disabled police officers. For the most part, we do. But under current law, police officers who are severely injured early in their careers get the least support of anyone. If you're permanently totally disabled in the line of duty but too young to retire normally, you will be financially destroyed. In 2008, there was a verbal agreement by the para executive director to study the sufficiency of disability benefits for disabled cops as a part of the omnibus pension bill discussion. The economy tanked right after that, and para decided not to do the study. Since then, changes in both work comp and pension law have made the disparities in benefits even larger. Without a study, we will continue to have a stalemate between work comp and pensions, with no one taking action to protect the young cops who are losing everything. I've been working on this issue for many years, and every time I talk to a committee, they always say it's not, we don't have any data, we only have anecdotes, and it's not within our purview, as I understand your position today. But without the Department of Labor and Industry and the pensions folks talking to each other, nobody understands the depth of this problem. My husband is a disabled police officer. He was 40 when he got hurt. And he was the commander of the bomb squad, was injured by a blast, and he has a brain injury. He has been unable to work for the last 14 years. His total benefits are less than half of what he would be making if he were still able to work. It has a totally different offset in the work comp system for people who are permanently totally disabled and not old enough to retire normally as a police officer. We fell through a horrible crack in the system, and we may never fix the crack that my family fell through, but I want to make sure that nobody else falls through the same crack that we did. And the longer we put this off, the longer the problem, more people fall through that crack. It's a small number of people. We estimate, the Department of Labor and Industry estimated that it's one or two people per year that are permanently totally disabled in police work, but many of those are already old enough to retire. We don't have an exact number of how many young people become permanently totally disabled because nobody is keeping statistics on that. This information is crucial to be able to make intelligent decisions about what the benefits should be to make sure that severely injured workers are protected. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Are there any questions for the witness? Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Wendy Wolf, for appearing today. And to the amendment, I appreciate you bringing it forward, Representative Kosnick. I've had conversation with the commissioner. And I think she might share some comments on some resolution to this, and we'll be working on this in the future, I'm certain. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair, Representative Sundin, department is fully we would be happy to sit down with you and talk about what is the data that we would need to be able to do the kind of assessment that you're talking about, at least to the extent that the data is within our purview. And conceivably, we can move on this short of legislation, but also the department is happy to put this language on the Work Comp Advisory Council agenda for its next meeting so that we can have a discussion there, and we can then it can have gone through the process to have then a further discussion in the next legislative session. But I'm not sure we need to wait to start to collect some of this information now.
Did Representative Haley have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just a comment, if I may. I just want to thank you for your indulgence to have the testifier come forward and thank Representative Kosnick for bringing this. I have a police officer in my district who is one of those that's fallen through the same crack. So thank you for bringing this to our attention, and I appreciate the comments, Representative Sundin and Commissioner, that everybody's willing to work on this because it for the folks that it impacts, it impacts them greatly, and I would hope that we could do something to fix it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the conversation here, and for the commissioner, your commitment to continue to look into this and work with us on this, and Representative Sundin as well. And so, again, Ms. Wolf, I thank you for bringing this to my attention, and I know it's been very difficult on your family and challenging, and you're doing this for the right reasons to hopefully as a legislature we can minimize the damage and oversight that's in current statute. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I would withdraw my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. But I'm going to add a couple words here. I certainly understand a young person's disability, total and complete disability, and the benefits that they get. I sat on the Work Comp Committee commission probably at least 2 years too long. But it's not only police officers that get caught in this particular crack. I know pipe fitters, I know construction workers that are that have been hurt in their 30s and 40s and are totally disabled and have the same kind of financial problems that the Wolf family seems to have had. And it is very frustrating to have to go through the Work Comp Advisory Council because you have, I think it's 4 votes from business and 4 votes from labor or somewhere in that particular number. And these men and women get caught up in a tie vote, so nothing moves. And it's kind of the same problem we had with the PTSD last year. Was it last year or the year before? Because that had been on the agenda for the Work Comp Advisory for a good number of years. and the testimony I heard at the Work Comp Advisory Board on PTSD for emergency for that which has happened to emergency personnel. So it is a problem at the Work Comp Board. But for the people who have not been here prior to my coming here, and I've been here 20 years, I will say that the stories that were told by some of the members that had been here a long time by the time I got here, they were literally one step away from fistfights on the House floor over work comp. And the work comp rules would change every year or every time there was a change of majority. So the workers were whipsawed, not knowing what they had and didn't have for a lifetime of disability or anything else. So I think this is the best solution to a horrible problem, which is to have the council. And we vet them through that. But we can legislatively require them to look at something. We can't legislatively require them to look at it for very long if they choose not to. But I take the commissioner at her word. She has always been straightforward, honest, and sometimes over-informing, but that's a pleasant kind of piece to it. If this does not get some attention between now and whenever we come back, February or whatever, I certainly hope you bring this bill in front of the committee, and it will very likely pass through here very quickly. So with that, thank you, Ms. Wolf. I appreciate your bringing this forward.
Thank you.
We have the 2311 as amended. I make the motion. Would you care to make the motion to send it to Ways and Means?
Chair Mahoney, I'd like to forward 2311 as amended to Ways and Means.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
You're on your way to Ways and Means. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate you coming in at this early time. This committee hearing was scheduled when everybody was figuring on 9 a.m. starts the session. So I apologize for the early morning, and I couldn't get to the bakery myself. So with that, I think this hopefully will be our last meeting, and I want everyone to know I appreciate your work this year, and we'll see where we end up in another week and a half. Thank you. We stand adjourned.